Mordecai.
Mordecai.
Charlie Mordecai?
Bit of a moron, actually.
Oh, I believe I've just shot Joel.
Excellent shot, sir!
Man down!
Mr. Rollins and Mrs. Costello Evangelista are talking Mr. McCabe and Mrs. Miller on the Cut Print Film Podcast number 46. Here are your hosts, Jeff, Dave, and Chris.
Hello and welcome to the Cut Print Film Podcast, episode 46. I'm your host, with the most, Dave Costell. Here with me tonight is these two beautiful gentlemen.
Oh, what's going on? Dave had a stroke before the show started.
I'm Jeff Rollins.
If you could only see the look on Jeff Rollins' face right now. And I'm Chris Evangelista.
And we're a podcast about movies.
That's right.
That's the first time I ever said that on this podcast.
It took you a full year, but you finally mentioned what the show's about.
So if you've stumbled upon us looking for a podcast about books or music, get out of here.
Yeah, this is not your podcast.
Or, you know, just listen anyway. Why not?
That's true, yeah.
We'll take it.
Maybe you've seen a movie or two in your life.
Yeah, it's possible.
And you want to hear us talk about something.
Yeah, in that case, this is a podcast about books and music. We'll get to that later. No, just keep listening.
We'll take what we can get at this point. Anyway, if you're interested, and I'd fully understand if you're not interested after that intro, please, you could go to cutprintfilm.com to see our reviews, editorials, all that sort of stuff.
You can also find all the old episodes of this very podcast if you actually have a self-loathing that can't be quenched.
But you won't find episode one, because even we admit that was terrible.
Episode one has been completely scrubbed from the record.
Yeah.
It's been redacted.
At this point, we should probably get rid of two as well.
Yeah. Episodes two, not a great start. If you want to start with this podcast at a good point...
45.
Yeah, maybe episode 45 that we recorded last week.
Yeah, and skip this week's episode and jump to next week if you can.
Anyway, you can also find us on Twitter at @CutPrintFilm.
That's right.
And be our friend on Facebook, won't you? We won't block you. We'll poke and like everything.
That's right. Not a lot has gone on this week in the world of movies. Well, I mean, that's not true. It's just that there's not a lot of movie news because this week is Sundance, so all the legit critics are off at Sundance seeing a bunch of...
It's cold there at Sundance.
That's what I hear. They're saying a bunch of really good movies, but we here back in the normal area, we don't have good movies. So what came out this week, everyone?
Two movies came out. One was by Lucasfilm.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, it was called Strange Magic.
It was an animated movie, right?
Yes.
You're not the only one who forgot about it, because no one saw it.
Yes, apparently George Lucas himself forgot about the film because there was no advertising for it.
Yes.
The other film that came out this weekend, in which there was a bountiful amount of advertising, was the Johnny Depp comedy Mordecai.
Oh!
And if you're not familiar with Mordecai... you're probably in good company, because America didn't see this film. It made about $4.6 million.
You've at least seen the name somewhere, though, because of the aggressive advertising campaign.
I think it's safe to say that everyone has heard of this film, just no one knows what the hell it is. So our own Jeff Rollins was brave enough to go see Mordecai.
Strapped on a Kevlar vest and a helmet. Went into the theater.
Yeah,
were you the only person in the theater?
100% correct.
Wow, the entire time? No, last-minute stragglers?
Not a one.
That's shocking.
I went to the screening, and I saw as I was walking in the lobby, you know how they have all the films playing that night, American Sniper was also playing at this theater, and there were a lot of people in the lobby buying tickets, and two of the showings of American Sniper were sold out. Mordecai, though... not a problem. Everybody could get into Mordecai.
Free and clear.
But they chose instead, this was a 7 o'clock showing, they chose to buy tickets for the 10 p.m. showing of American Sniper and just wait it out.
In 5 weeks, American Sniper has made $200 million.
Especially because it was a Thursday night. I can't believe it was selling out on a Thursday.
Yeah. So I moseyed on into Mordecai by my lonesome, sat down in my seat, and strapped in. And 5 minutes into the film, I thought, oh, boy, this is going to be the whole thing, isn't it? And it just the tone was dull, and the film itself is just dead on arrival.
What's it about? What is Mordecai about? Because the trailers don't give us any idea.
No, they don't. These trailers just—it's just a clip show of wacky things happening. Right. It's almost like one of those montages America's Funniest Home Videos does, where everybody—it ends with somebody getting hit in the groin with a baseball or
it's
something.
Kind of like the Mr. Turner trailer.
Mordecai,
Mr. Turner.
Yeah, they
instead of everybody screaming Mr. Turner, they're all saying Mordecai
over and over again. Yeah. They also point out that he has a mustache.
Oh, they point that out a lot in the film.
Oh, good. So yeah, so give us a breakdown.
All right, Mordecai is directed by David Koepp, and he did Stir of Echoes, is a film I don't have a big problem with. I kind of like Stir of Echoes,
and he's written a lot of it. He wrote the Jurassic Park screenplay. He did a lot of stuff with Spielberg.
Really?
Yeah. He's primarily known as a screenwriter, every once in a while he'll direct. He directed Premium Rush, which was terrible.
Yeah, it's a good film. this is not an original property. This is adapted from a British series of novels written by
Tom Clancy.
Nope,
they're written by Mordecai himself, the real Mordecai.
No, they might as well be. They're written by a man named Kirill Bonfiglioli.
What a good name.
Bonfiglioli.
I thought that was an Italian pastry treat, but I must have been wrong. So this stars Johnny Depp, Gwyneth Paltrow, Ewan McGregor, Paul Bettany, and Olivia Munn.
Do they all play Mordecai?
They all play Mordecai.
And Jeff Goldblum's in there somewhere, according to the trailer.
Yeah, he's got a cameo. He's in it for about 5 minutes.
I mean, this is a fairly okay cast for the most part.
The budget for this thing was all cast and promotion, and nothing was spent on tightening up the story or jokes. They certainly had no money in the joke department.
their joke budget ran dry.
So the plot synopsis, according to Rotten Tomatoes, and this is a bare bones plot here. Juggling some angry Russians, the British MI5, his impossibly leggy wife.
Anyone who writes a sentence like that should be shot.
And an international terrorist, debonair art dealer, and part-time rogue, which I don't even know what that means.
That's also his Twitter handler. It's part-time rogue, the official Mordecai Twitter.
Full-time J-O. part-time rogue Charlie Mordecai, played by Johnny Depp, must traverse the globe armed only with his good looks and special charm in a race to recover a stolen painting rumored to contain the code to a lost bank account filled with Nazi gold.
Ugh. Nazi gold always makes for good comedy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Every time. Schindler's List? Come on. Now, that plot doesn't even become apparent until over an hour into the film.
Ugh.
And
so it's like Rock and Rolla?
Yeah, okay. Sort of. It's just as enjoyable.
Referencing weird movies about paintings that are British.
But this is nowhere near as exciting as Rock and Rolla. That was Guy Ritchie. Right?
Yeah.
He can at least direct things happening in a fun way. This David Koepp direction is almost non-existent. This is pretty much Johnny Depp having at it for an hour and 47 minutes.
It's just like a series of vignettes?
That's what it feels like. And they all feel like they were written by different people because the tone is completely off from scene to scene. In a 15-minute frame of this film, Mordecai will go from being a drunk to a complete invalid grown man to an old dithering man who even walks as though his back hurts, but there's no reference to that ever, to a kind of like a cad, a womanizer, but not really. I have no idea what this character is.
When does he become a terrorist?
Never.
That's how he was explained.
Never.
A part-time rogue? Is that ever in there?
I guess he's a part-time rogue because he says cheeky things. I mean, this movie stinks.
He's not a rogue long enough to get full benefits.
Correct.
Yes. He doesn't get paid time off from roguing.
He's only working a 35-hour week. He hasn't hit the 40-hour.
Yeah, if he goes above that, they send him home from roguing. You gotta go home. You're over here.
I'm sorry, Mordecai. You have to leave the roguery.
So this almost sounds like, and even from the design and the way the characters look, it sounds like someone other than Wes Anderson trying to make a Wes Anderson movie. Even the painting plot was just in Grand Budapest Hotel.
Yeah, and this
is that how it comes across?
This is I said it in my review, in which I gave this film a 2 out of 10 because it stinks. I said in my review that this feels like Johnny Depp doing his best impression of Ray Fiennes' character of M. Gustave in Wes Anderson's The Grand Budapest Hotel,
right,
which was filmed before this movie started production and came out, right, a year before this film came out. And after reading my review, Chris, I guess you did a little digging.
Yeah.
And what did you
So yeah, it turns out I
because this is incredible and very telling.
So Johnny Depp was actually originally cast in the Grand Budapest Hotel in the Ray Fiennes role. And then it says he dropped out. I don't know the full story. Maybe he got fired because he's not right for it.
From this performance, I'd say that he was asked to leave the set.
So it seems like basically Johnny Depp read the script for Grand Budapest, left that production, and then just took all the cues from that and applied it to this film.
Yeah. This film takes place in, I guess, 2014, 2015. It's a modern setting.
Right.
But Mordecai is straight out of, you know, the 1940s.
But is he doing like a Peter Sellers impression, like a Pink Panther?
Sort of. Like I said, the characterization is so off from scene to scene.
Because I got like Steve Martin Pink Panther meets The Love Guru. That's what the trailer seemed like to me.
Meets like Austin Powers. Yeah.
There's no Austin Powers. That would actually be funny. There's right. No satire here. This is all sight gags about the mustache and about how Mordecai... Like, they kind of make a point that Mordecai is this, you know, incompetent boob, but he's not.
Yeah,
because he's like also this art expert.
Yeah,
he's an expert in art.
Like, they come to him for help, so why would he be such a fucking boob? Like,
yeah, it's so...
Is that the joke, that they don't know he's a boob?
No,
or?
Well, if that's the joke's on us.
Are there any mustache rides in the film?
Not a one.
Damn it. But I was hoping that R rating would...
Yeah, so yeah, what's that about? Why is this rated R? Because that's...
I don't know.
They don't say fuck or anything?
There's one fuck. See, they drop the F-bomb one
but
time.
You're actually allowed two fucks in PG-13. And you're allowed to say fuck as long as it's not in referencing to sex. Is that what the fuck is in this? Do they say, like, they're fucking in there? Do they say that? No?
Nope.
All right. Does he say, fuck my mustache?
He doesn't.
Because that's not allowed.
Oh, all right.
Yeah,
not even in an R-rated film.
The MPAA won't stand for that.
There's hardly any violence, and the violence that there is cartoon violence.
That's so weird. Why is it rated R?
I have no idea. There's no nudity.
All right. I was going to say, are there sexual situations?
The sexiest this thing comes is Gwyneth Paltrow disrobes and gets in a bath at the end, but she's only seen from the back.
Do you see her bum?
Nope.
All right, then. I don't know what this is about.
This is one of the few cases where I just can't figure out why this movie's rated R.
Yeah, it's strange.
For some language and sexual material.
No, that's a lie.
Some language.
That's all it says. It literally says some language.
That's strange.
Did you guys have any other questions for the Morty Q&A?
Does anyone call him Morty?
No.
Morticia?
No.
You got any more
These
names?
Are riveting questions.
I'm just...
Teddy.
Why was this movie made is my question. I don't know.
I really don't know. These books came out in the 70s, and I guess they were popular enough to, you know, become a part of British pop culture,
right,
at some level. I don't know how popular these are.
I almost feel like bad for Mordecai, the people involved with it, because
I feel bad for Gwyneth Paltrow and Ewan McGregor.
Right.
I have no mercy for Johnny Depp.
I don't know what the fuck Johnny Depp's problem is. He needs to take some time off. A part of me wishes, not Grand Budapest, because that would have been all wrong, but I wish he would work with a director like that who could, like, pull him out of the muck, you know?
Jim,
like,
Burton, that's the man. He's the man for the job.
Because I don't think Johnny Depp is a bad actor. I just think he's gotten fucking lazy. He's gotten so lazy because he knows he can get an easy payday. And, you know, I can't fault him for that because, like, if someone was saying, here's a bunch of money, you can lazily sleepwalk through a film, I'd be like, all right, I'll do that.
He's working hard in this film.
Really?
He is mugging for the camera.
Well, that's even more depressing.
He's working. Man. He's not just slumming it, but there's no jokes to be found in this thing. It's awful.
That's very weird.
Does he score any touchdowns in the film?
Not one.
Oh, damn it.
No, I don't even know where you were going with that.
I'm just trying to think of questions.
I wanted to say, I read an article, and it was just a... not a very good article. It was one of those clickbait things, and the headline asked, "Is Johnny Depp and Gwyneth Paltrow's careers a result of the Miramax curse?" Which is something that the writer of the article just completely made up.
I love those. Yeah.
And if you were wondering, no, they never answer that question.
Was Quentin Tarantino ever affected by this Miramax curse? That
you mean the third Weinstein?
Yeah.
But the article did. It raised a lot of good questions, never answers any of them.
Oh, good. I love those articles.
But it just goes on and on about how people like Gwyneth Paltrow and Johnny Depp and Catherine Zeta-Jones and...
Kevin Costner.
Not Kevin Costner, but Renee Zellweger. These people that made their a lot of big films, big popular films in the mid-90s for Miramax... Now they can't have it. They don't have a hit to save their lives.
At the same time, though, like Gwyneth Paltrow is part of the Marvel universe, so it's like
sort of. She's an incidental.
She is,
character.
But she got a really big part in Iron Man 3. Actually, like they beefed her part up in that, and I actually thought she was good in that. I don't mind Gwyneth Paltrow.
I like Gwyneth Paltrow a lot. But, you know, Catherine Zeta-Jones, she's fallen off the map.
I don't know what the hell she's
doing. Renee Zellweger. I mean, that's second Bridges Jones film. She's gone.
That's an interesting – I mean, the article sounds like bullshit, but it's an interesting theory because it's true. I mean, I don't know. Miramax has this thing where
– well, once the Weinsteins left Miramax
– right.
the game's over.
But like back in the day, Miramax – they were the studio that just, they just pushed these movies for like awards even though they didn't deserve
these very small movies too.
It's
Shakespeare in Love.
Yeah, they were one of like the first Sundance studios to like start buying shit out of Sundance. Yeah,
I don't know. I want Johnny Depp to just take a few years off, which he won't because they're already. I think Pirates whatever 6 starts filming next week.
Mordecai 2 is being written as
Mordecai on the Moon got canceled, I believe.
Or if Johnny Depp did something with like Jonathan Glazer, where it was just like an insane small movie,
It seems like a generic choice, but like Tarantino has like that.
Yeah,
he has that rep for saving careers, and it would be so cool if he did a film with him, and where he's not the lead, where he was just like a secondary character,
like Aronofsky. He could be like the Wrestler too.
Yeah, just something he needs. That's what he the Wrestler too.
Does that sound like a bad idea?
He needs something like that though. He needs someone to resurrect his career and remind us that like. Oh, he can do good things. Maybe this like Black Mass movie will do it. That's coming out.
Yeah,
who's directing that?
Black Mass? I don't know. All but that's the story of Whitey Bulger, and Johnny Depp plays Whitey Bulger, and it looks interesting. And that's the kind of role I like to see Johnny Depp in.
Yeah, like Donnie Brasco.
Yeah, something where he's, you know.
All right, it's being directed by
a cartoon character
by Scott Cooper, who's directed. Crazy Heart. So never mind.
Oh, I like Crazy Heart. I did like Crazy Heart.
Crazy Heart's not terrible.
It was too cookie cutter for me.
It's maudlin.
Yeah.
But that's a film I'd like to see him in more dramatic roles. Like if this cast were a dramatic cast, I would have been in the theater.
He needs a film where he's not playing a wacky character with a wacky hat that's all he plays anymore. Like in this film, he has the mustache. That's his wacky hat for this.
Yeah,
film.
He's always got a head accessory on. And in this film, like you said, it's the mustache. Earlier in 2014, it was wires coming out of his fucking head.
It's like
he's terrible.
Yeah, that movie was horrible.
Transcendence.
I forgot about that movie. It's like it's weird to think that Johnny Depp used to do movies where he didn't have to wear a bunch of goofy fucking makeup, like
or act goofy.
This isn't a great movie, but he made a movie. It's called like Nick of Time, where he's just a normal guy in that movie. It's just a normal guy where he wears a suit. It's like he doesn't do that anymore. It's strange.
And I like Johnny Depp. I would prefer him as a character actor where he's not the star of the film. I like him in smaller doses. Or if he is the star, I like him.
It's a smaller movie.
I like him doing less. Like Edward Scissorhands. He's the star of that, but he's mute.
He's better as like better as the straight
essentially,
man.
He's mute.
He doesn't. Yes. Like, even Edward Scissorhands, where he's ghastly in appearance, he's the straight man. Yeah. Like, he needs to. Like, those Pirates movies are the worst thing that ever happened to Johnny Depp because it turned him in, like, look at how wacky he is. Uh-huh. And, like, you look at, What's Eating Gilbert Grape? He's the most normal character in that movie. And it's, like, not anymore. Now he's always got to be the goofy guy.
It's awful.
It's sad.
And everyone loses.
It's not sad for him. He's got a truck full of money, but.
I'm trying to think, though. He's never been great, though.
You don't think so?
I don't think he's ever been great, but I do like him in, you know, reserved roles.
I would say he's great in Edward Scissorhands, because that's not at all what he's really like. He's such a timid, like, weak character in that movie.
And I think Anthony Michael Hall's great in that.
The murderous bully who gets stabbed.
I think Johnny Depp should do a role like Captain Kirk in Star Trek. That would be a good one.
That's good. All right.
Star Trek 3.
Dave, let me put on my big right boxing on glove. Knock you in the noggin. So yeah, Mordecai, go see it.
No, stay away from Mordecai like the rest of the country did.
It made $4 million, came in ninth place behind...
How many theaters was this film in?
2,070.
Boy, is that not good.
2,648.
That's embarrassing.
It was behind the aforementioned Strange Magic, which came in seventh place.
That's such a good contrast, because Strange Magic had no marketing and it somehow beat Mordecai, so much marketing.
So yeah, that's our discussion on Mordecai.
Right.
And I was left asking, Morda why?
Oh.
And if you want more of this podcast, stick around after this break it to Kai.
Dave, you're fired. Ah, come forth and let me tell you the tale of CutPrintFilm.com, a film review, editorial, and news website.
Have they got any loot there?
They do. Oh, I can't find it. Does anyone know where the loot is?
I have one right here.
CutPrint Film has a merry band of men.
Do they drop the beat?
Yes, they do! It includes More Like Radio, Joystick Jerks, and Anti-Fanboy.
Lemons, lemons, lemons.
Official Mordecai soundtrack.
Oh, I thought this was McCabe and Mrs. Miller soundtrack. Period. That's appropriate.
Mr. McCabe. Mrs. Miller.
Welcome back, everyone, to the CutPrint Film Podcast. So, we just got done talking about Mordecai, and now we're going to move on to a...
Lestecai.
We're going to talk about a film in our director series, which... If you don't know what that is, we pick a director, we pick three films from the director, and we talk about those three films over a period of shows.
And what this does, in my summation, is it inspires you and us to watch movies we wouldn't necessarily watch.
Right.
By directors we might not really know a whole lot about beforehand.
Right, and we got a really nice fan letter, which we weren't expecting, and suggesting a future director, so... What was that fellow's name who sent us the letter?
Will from California.
So thanks, Will from California.
Yes,
and
we got your letter.
He suggested a...
In the mail.
No, it was an email.
Yeah, by Pony Express it came. So he suggested a director. I won't name the director in case we pick him next time. But if you out there in podcast land have a director you want us to tackle, send us an email. Go for it. Or tweet at us. Go on Facebook. Whatever.
And please send us football pads so we don't hurt ourselves once we tackle them.
So we picked Robert Altman because everyone talks about him like he's the Jesus of cinema.
Right.
Yeah.
And we're kind of we're not on board the Altman train. So
no. In fact, my Altman back catalog is very, very, very tiny. I've seen Popeye.
I've seen a few Altman films before we started this, and I won't say I'm a fan, but I think we have some production for the director series, don't we?
We do. Let me just pull it up.
No, right. We don't.
Okay. Oh, all right.
It's the CutPrint Film Director Series. Action.
Directors!
Pass the popcorn. Put a piece in my mouth.
Thank you.
All right, so you can look forward to hearing that for the rest of the year.
Yes, till we change it. So I have a little brief bio on Robert Altman, which, again, I write all these bios. I do not copy and paste them from Rotten Tomatoes.
You're pronouncing his name wrong. It's Robert Alt Rockman.
What?
Wow.
I don't really understand the joke.
It's actually Robert Control Alt Deleteman is the
name.
Okay, that's better.
Nope. Not one instance of this.
I like them both. But
all right, well, as long as we make Jeff angry, it's a success. So here's the brief Robert Altman bio. Again, I wrote this. It's not from Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay.
During the 1970s, an era widely recognized as a renaissance period of American movie making, few directors enjoyed greater prominence than Robert Altman, an iconoclast whose work accurately and acutely attacked the conventions of genre filmmaking. Altman both satirized and revitalized genres like the Western, the musical, and the crime drama, waging war on the sterile artifice of mainstream storytelling by creating a singularly sprawling and deliberately messy cinematic world. Famed for his invention, famed for his inventive brand of overlapping and often improvisational dialogue, and an acknowledged master of modern camera technique, Altman's quixotic career has been uneven at best, yet he remains a pivotal figure of contemporary cinema.
I like how that rolled right off your tongue.
Yeah.
That was not cumbersomely worded at all.
Well.
Kudos to whoever wrote that. More consonants, please. We need more in a row.
Altman's a handsome-looking fella. He's got like a Hemingway thing going on. Yeah.
In my defense, I had to read that with one eye because my fucking microphone was blocking the big thing.
I can relate to that.
Also, I'm really stupid.
You never learned to read.
You had to read with one eye because Jeff punched your other one out.
Yeah, for the joke we made before we started.
Oh, man. All right, so as we said, we're talking about Robert Altman for the next three director series.
Three years.
Whoa, I hope not. And for the next, I don't know if we're going to do 3 weeks in a row, but for the next three director series that we talk about Altman films, we're going to be tackling Popeye for every episode.
Yes. So,
man, that was a very stoically laid out joke. It almost convinced me it was true.
It almost made me take the suicide pill I have in this fake tooth.
Just kidding, everyone. This week we're talking about his 1971 film, McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Which is actually almost like an Old West Popeye.
It certainly is,
it's
actually.
Like, yeah.
It really is.
Wait, have we ever explained to the audience that one of us picks each of these films?
We haven't, because we're bad at this.
Is that a secret? Or
we've talked about it as though they knew already, but we never really explained
it. We each pick one of the movies,
right,
if you've not, if you haven't caught on to that yet.
Yeah, we each pick a director, and then the three of us pick one of the three movies.
Yeah. And who picked it this week?
It was Dave's pick for Altman, and it was my pick for McCabe and Mrs. Miller because...
I thought this was Jeff's pick. No, confused.
It's mine because based solely on the Roger Ebert review, which said this was his best film. So I said, all right, let's go with it.
Yeah, so this movie came out in 1971, right off the heels of Vietnam. And it stars Warren Beatty as the... McCabe, yes, of the title.
The titular McCabe, if you will.
John McCabe. It also stars Julie Christie as Constance Miller, who you may have heard referred to as Mrs. Miller,
yes,
in the title of the film. Also, there's a lot of character actors that populate Altman films. Renee Auberjonois, who plays the barkeep Sheehan. William Devane creeps up for 6 seconds. As a lawyer, and Shelley Duvall is listed in the credits for no reason at all, but she's in it, sort of.
Yeah, I thought she was going to have a bigger part when I saw her name.
She almost has no part.
Yeah, she barely says anything.
So, plot synopsis that, you know, I wrote this. This is definitely not taken from Rotten Tomatoes at all, much like Chris's Altman bio.
I hope it rolls off your tongue as easily as mine did.
You know what? I'm scared to death now. I really hope that the same guy didn't do both, because
I probably shouldn't have drank a lot before I read that also, because that didn't help.
McCabe and Mrs. Miller is a mixture of mediocre multimedia. Which is all alliterative.
Here goes nothing, folks.
Good luck.
Memorably. Oh, all right. All right. Terrible start.
All right. We're off to a great start.
Memorably described by critic Pauline Kael as a beautiful pipe dream of a movie, Robert Altman's McCabe and Mrs. Miller reimagines the American West as a muddy frontier filled with hustlers, opportunists, and corporate sharks, a turn-of-the-century model for a 1971 America mired in violence and lies. John McCabe, played by Warren Beatty, wanders into the turn-of-the-century wilderness village known as Presbyterian Church, with vague plans of parlaying his gambling winnings into establishing a fancy casino brothel bathhouse. McCabe's business partner is prostitute and madam, Mrs. Miller, played by Julie Christie. who, despite her apparent distaste for McCabe, helps him achieve his goal. And once McCabe and Mrs. Miller become successful, the town grows and prospers, incurring the jealousy of a local mining company that wants to buy McCabe out. Filmed on location in Canada, McCabe and Mrs. Miller makes use of such Altman, quote-unquote, stock company performers as Shelley Duvall, Rene Auberjonois, John Shuck, and Keith Carradine. The seemingly improvised screenplay was based on a novel by Edmund Naughton, and the movie features a soundtrack of songs by Leonard Cohen. McCabe and Mrs. Miller joined such other Altman efforts as MASH, The Long Goodbye, and Thieves Like Us in radically revising the familiar movie genres for the disillusioned Vietnam era.
So that, beautiful.
I mean, that was a pretty good synopsis.
Yeah, that wasn't bad. Yeah.
I wrote for myself.
Yeah, good work. You didn't trip all over it like I did, like a buffoon.
Who does Keith Carradine play? I don't remember him.
He's the cowboy who gets shot on the bridge and he falls into the ice.
Wow, he's so young. So young.
He had to be like 19
that
years
was,
old.
Geez. That was a long time ago, back before they found his corpse in a closet.
Yes. No, that was David Carradine.
Oh, sorry.
his brother.
This is his still working brother.
Oh, his still living brother.
Yes. So... McCabe and Mrs. Miller, it's essentially a Western, but it's more like an anti-Western.
Yeah, it is the anti-Western.
Yeah,
like a deconstruction of the Western. And we're kind of used to this now because we see it a lot in films like The Assassination of Jesse James and even Deadwood, which was is essentially HBO three series. Seasons of this movie.
Right. Or even like There Will Be Blood, I would say, is sort of like an definitely. Anti-Western.
Yeah, we'll get to that. This is there's definitely echoes of There Will Be Blood in this.
But at this point, they hadn't seen that in Westerns
this
at all.
This is brand new. Yeah. And it takes place... It doesn't even take place in the Wild West. This takes place in the Pacific Northwest, which is...
Don't you mean the Wiki Wild West?
This takes place in the Wiki Wild West. I just bite it. I don't light it. Is that what we do?
What?
I don't know.
I don't know anything after Wiki.
When does the giant robot spider come in?
I know me and Artemis. That's like the next one.
Hopefully no one's hit pause at this point. But
they hit their ejector seat button. Get me out of this podcast.
So yeah, this is the anti-Western. It takes place in the Pacific Northwest in a town called Presbyterian Church. And this, I want to talk about the music, but first I want to talk about the town itself.
Right.
Okay. The town the music was recorded in?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, that would be stupid.
What a bad way to take that conversation. The town of Presbyterian Church was built on location.
Right. This is
yes.
Yeah. The one thing I really, I like the movie in general, but the one thing I really liked about the movie is how authentic it. Like, it felt like it felt like they went back in time and made this movie. Basically,
I was transported. Like, I don't think I have been since There Will Be Blood.
Well, I don't want to get too much into the Will Be Blood, but
all right. Well,
he did the same thing. Like, he built the whole set for The Will Be Blood.
And it's also... Sorry, go ahead.
The thing about what... Like, the cast lived in the town. Like, they lived on set. Because there's nowhere else to go. They're in the middle of nowhere.
Right, as did this cast.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. In both movies.
Yeah.
But in this particularly. And some of the guys, like, helped build the set who were working as actors were also carpenters.
Are you talking about The Will Be Blood or this film?
Mr. McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Right, and you can actually see people building... parts of the set that hadn't been filmed yet, because this film was filmed in sequence, which is something that's almost unheard of. But yeah, so you can actually see the set being built in the background by extras and carpenters with period appropriate tools, which is incredible.
Yeah, it is. And it also, I said this earlier, but it's like this is a weird sort of prototype for Altman's Popeye, because Popeye has that same thing where he built this entire...
The ship.
This seaside village, basically, and it's this whole thing where it's a bunch of...
Is that why there's so much spinach in this?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's why McCabe rolls up his sleeves and has those anchor tattoos that come to life. They shoot the battleships. They shoot the cannons.
But that's interesting that it was filmed sequentially, because you get to see the town go up as the movie progresses.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It becomes more and more refined, and the buildings and get windows
and everything like feels like lived in. It's like these like they feel like they belong there.
It's filthy. This is a filthy town. Everything's covered in mud.
Right.
And that's intentional too, because as we find out that this is... You know, coming off the heels of Vietnam, this is a disillusioned America that are dealing with, the machine of war and not only that, but the machine of capitalism.
Right. There's a big, like, sort of like little guy versus industry. Yeah, like industry in this movie.
And this is a regular Rage Against the Machine.
If you will. I hear Hoover, he was a body remover.
Oh, he sure was.
I can't remember any lyrics. So I guess. I love sorry, the guys out there.
I love like the natural elements. Like I love that the snow is real snow. Like a lot of times, I get really taken out in a movie where I can tell the snow is fake. Like it'll fall. Like it'll be snowing, and the snow will fall on a character, and it doesn't melt. It just stays there. It's like that. The real snow doesn't do that. And like there's the whole ending. I don't want to jump all the way to the ending, but the ending of this movie, there's this whole sequence where characters are just like. They're up to their chests in snow, and you can tell
it's something that's almost unheard of.
Right.
Aside from films like The Shining, like you typically don't have a finale that takes place in the snow, especially a Western.
No,
that's unheard of.
Just like logistically, those scenes of him like wading through the snow. I was thinking about how they would have to do multiple takes. You got to completely move the location because you can't relay the snow to make. Well, and this snow was naturally falling.
I have an interesting little side story about this. So
the snow was fake.
So no, Warren Beatty he loved to make multiple. He loved to do multiple takes, which Robert Altman did not like to do. And so Warren Beatty kept insisting on multiple takes and scenes. And so to get back at him. The ending scene where Warren Beatty is like stuck in the snow. Warren Beatty made him film that again and again.
Oh, Robert Altman made.
Robert Altman made Warren Beatty film that again and again. Just to be an asshole, basically.
And it's the last scene in the because they filmed it sequentially. Yeah. It was the end of the
show.
So Robert Altman was just like, "Oh, you like to do multiple takes? Here, do multiple takes of you just sitting in the fucking snow."
That is. That's great because that shows Altman has a great sense of humor.
Yes, and he hated Warren Beatty.
So back to what I was saying about the town itself and how real it is, how authentic it feels. This is, and to borrow a cliche term, the town is another character in and of itself.
Oh,
just like the music can be in certain films. I really feel like the town is a living, breathing thing here.
It is because there's a shot where you see them like riding their horses back when they're putting the church steeple up. And then at the end of the movie, the church steeple is like fully built and it's on fire. And
Yeah.
And like a character in a story that grows and changes, the town grows and changes because of that sequential filming and the building of the set as they filmed. I don't know.
And it
really did a lot for me.
That final scene, it goes throughout the whole town. And there's the scene where he's in the steeple looking over the whole town.
Yeah.
And then like you kind of you know the town so well by the end of the movie that you could tell where the guys are like that are hunting him. And you're like, oh, don't go over there because that guy's over there.
Yeah, they've done such a great job establishing the town itself that it's just so natural to follow. You know what the next thing's going to be.
Which is incredible.
It's one of the best portrayals of a place and time I've ever seen in a film. And by place, I just mean like the logistics of the town. Like, I can't remember a lot of films that do that so well, where it perfectly encapsulates the era it's trying to portray and just this small little plot of land it's trying to build up.
All right. Yeah, I can't think of any.
The closest thing I think of is like Deadwood, which is a TV show. But
this reminded me so much of Deadwood.
Yeah.
The characters and the town itself, the filthiness of
the dirt. Yeah, because in that making of the Deadwood, like I remember they would have to go into a tent and they would literally like spray them with dirt before each shoot, which I assumed in this they just made them roll around in dirt because
it's just complete mud. Everywhere.
Probably I saw a set photo of like Warren Beatty like just walking and he's just like covered in mud and he just looks fucking miserable in the photo.
Okay, so moving on from the town itself, the very first thing that we're given here in this film is the music,
right?
Which is by Leonard Cohen. There's three songs that they use that are one of them is repeated a couple times, but the first song we hear is the Stranger song,
right?
And it's played over the opening credits and as we are first introduced to Warren Beatty's John McCabe. And Dave, you said something interesting when you were watching it.
I hated the music.
You just wanted this man to stop singing.
Just please stop singing.
I mean,
are you not a Leonard Cohen fan?
It's not that. It's just like it didn't fit the tone of the film to me. It was too fairy tale-ish?
I don't think that. I love Leonard Cohen. I think Leonard Cohen is fucking fantastic. And I think the credits music is great. I did think there's a scene later in the film where it's when McKay brings the three prostitutes he buys to the town. And, like, action will happen, then, like, it'll cut to, like, the middle of this song. I didn't think that worked.
That was specifically when I said that to you guys.
That just seemed uncinematic to me. But fucking Altman loves being uncinematic, which I'm sure we'll get to.
I loved the music.
I mean, the songs themselves I fucking love.
They're beautiful.
Because I just love Leonard Cohen.
I have no issue with the actual music. I just feel like it didn't work in the film.
I thought they worked excellently in the film. Because
I think over the credits are fantastic. I love the way the credits scroll
sideways.
I love that. Leonard Cohen is such miserable music. It perfectly sets the tone for the film.
Well, yeah, and these songs, the lyrics of the songs, these were not written for the film, but they work as a narrative.
Right.
They work as narration to introduce first McCabe with the Stranger song and then the prostitutes that he purchases for $200. the song that's played is Sisters of Mercy, which is what you said you hated. And then when we're introduced to Mrs. Miller.
I think it's Blackbird. Blackbird singing in the dead of night.
No, it's a song called Winter Lady. And I don't know. For me, this music worked so well. It's part what you said, Chris, about it being miserable.
Right.
And this being just a rainy, muddy, filthy town that it's a one saloon town with these hideous prostitutes. And I just thought it was perfect.
I mean, yeah, I don't think it didn't fit the tone. I do think it fits the tone.
And I can see how I absolutely can see how you would not like this music. For me, it worked in spades.
It just had like a Puff the Magic Dragon vibe to
really?
It.
Really?
It's so dark.
I completely disagree with that.
Leonard Cohen is like music for fucking suicide. Yeah. If you're going to kill yourself, you should get in the tub, put on some Leonard Cohen, and just open up those wrists.
I guess I'm just spoiled by Johnny Greenwood and the There Will Be Blood soundtrack.
Well, you get some of that. You get some of that jarring, mandolin music during the naturalistic score of the film. Because there's always a guy playing a
violin or a mandolin.
Or like a ukulele.
Yeah, or a ukulele. And it's always terrible. It's like this
droning
cacophony of sound.
That's actually reminiscent of Wild with the Simon and Garfunkel song kind of plays throughout the thing, and it's just that same mandolin.
I mean, the only thing I have to say about the Cohen music not working is the only time I didn't like it was that specific scene I outlined, because it just bothered me how. And it's not that so much it bothered me, it's just that I'm not used to that in a movie, because it's not like other movies, which is what fucking Altman wanted to do, which I'll get to when I sum up.
Right, so let's dive into the plot and the performances here.
Well, one thing I like and I don't like simultaneously is Altman's love of overlapping dialogue.
Oh my god.
So here's an example of what that sounds like if you're unfamiliar.
All right, we're going to have a discussion.
Say, McCabe, what are you doing over there with that fur coat?
What's happening? The movie just started, and I don't know what's happening.
Mrs. McCabe!
Is this a scene?
All right, so
yeah, that's the first 5 minutes of the film.
So Altman, and this isn't just in this movie, it's in a lot of his movies, he sort of pioneered this thing where he wanted this naturalistic sort of thing from his performances. So he encouraged improvisation, and he loved this overlapping dialogue thing, where basically what he would do is he would put little mics on all the actors and mic them all at once, and he would just edit all the sound together.
And the result is the sound that you hear if you were to walk into a crowded bar.
Right, which is realistic, which I appreciate, but Jesus Christ, does it get on your nerves.
And it's hard to follow, because some of these people are giving you some expository dialogue that you probably should be hearing, but
and
yeah,
what
he
does, and sometimes what he'll do is it's clearly like ADR work where he'll dub, and it's really obvious where there'll be all the mumbling, and then someone will say an important line, and you're looking right at them, and their lips aren't fucking moving.
I am a gambler.
Yeah, he's the guy who shot the guy. It's like,
he shot Bill Roundtree. Yeah.
Is that Chubby McCabe?
Yeah, and
does McCabe have a chubby?
again, I appreciate what Altman was trying to do, and it's ballsy.
On a technical level, it's genius.
And it's not like any other film you see, but...
In practice.
Yeah, the way it's done, it's kind of a mess. Yeah. And a part of me feels like there's a reason it's not done in other movies, because it's so fucking distracting.
Yeah, it's sort of anti-cinematic.
Right.
And it definitely takes you out of it. But still... I'm going to say that I would prefer hearing my exposition that way than somebody just telling me straight up, yeah. I am a miller. Mill things.
Sort of like, we need a black hat hacker named Hathaway.
Exactly like that. And you can read that black hat review on cutprintfilm.com, written by Chris Evangelista.
What a year for film.
It has a silky brim and a nice texture.
That's some hat. Hey, speaking of black hats... McCabe wears a black hat.
Man, that hat is fucking cool. I love the not so much all the costumes, but I love the way Warren Beatty is dressed in this movie. Like, it made me want to like be a complete douchebag and go out and get a bowler hat.
He's always the best dressed person in town,
right?
Which I think that's the point.
Himself,
yeah, that goes to his character because he thinks he's this like smooth operator, and as we learn, he's kind of just a fucking idiot. Yeah.
He's a fool.
Yeah,
it's like a mediocre dude going to like. A real shitty town and becoming the head of it before anyone else.
It's exactly like that.
It's sort of like me at my work where everyone thinks I'm a genius, really they're just idiots and I'm moderately intelligent.
So the basic plot line of this film is McCabe, played by Warren Beatty, comes into this town. There's whisperings that he killed a man over a card game.
Just to watch him die.
Well, no, that's a song. And
and he has a nickname.
There's no place for that talk here.
His nickname is Budgie, or is it Pudgy? Pudgy McCabe. Yeah. Yes, Chubby McCabe.
Pudgy.
Pudgy McCabe, which makes no sense.
So, yeah, he comes into this town. There's rumors that are unfounded that he killed a man over a game of cards.
Are they unfounded?
Well, actually...
Oh, I thought they were.
I think the big... not so much twist, but the reveal at the end is he is the killer because...
He shoots him with the Derringer.
Yeah, there's a big thing about the shot. They keep saying, oh, he killed the guy with a Derringer. And he pulls out... Because he's using another gun. And after he gets shot, he pulls out a gun that is a Derringer.
And it's like the... Inglourious Basterds, Django Unchained, where it just like comes out of his hand, kind of.
Right.
See, I thought of that as just a little bit of poetic justice and irony, but
I think you're not meant to know either
Chris's
way.
Okay, fair enough.
I think you're not meant to know either way, though. Yeah. I think it's like the third week in a row we're doing this, but it's ambiguous.
Yeah.
The ambiguity series.
I really do appreciate that. I love that in a film.
Because then we can wrestle over
it. Yeah, leg wrestle.
Yeah, chicken fights all around.
All right, get the canola oil. So, McCabe wanders into this town. They think he's a big wheel, if you will. And he decides, well, I'm going to open up a brothel. So he opens up a saloon brothel and purchases these three women for $200.
I believe the correct term from the period was busted. They're busted women.
They are busted women. They're worth every penny of that $200.
This movie takes place in the 90s.
And there is a rival saloon owner named Sheehan, played by Paul Dano. Oh, I'm sorry. That's incorrect. he's played by a man that looks exactly like Paul Dano. And he's essentially the Eli to McCabe's Daniel Plainview.
He doesn't have as big as a part, but
No, but you can definitely see the genesis of that Eli character.
And he's not the head of the church, but that church versus McCabe thing plays in a lot, too.
It does.
Yeah, well, we all know Paul Thomas Anderson has a big hard-on for Robert Altman, and he clearly got inspiration from this movie.
Yes, not so much. If you've seen Magnolia and you've seen Altman's...
Shortcuts.
Shortcuts specifically.
They're mostly the same movie, more or less.
There's a lot of that ensemble cast, but not so much in this film. This is a straight narrative starring Warren Beatty. But so, he sets up this brothel, and then a stagecoach comes in with this Cockney woman named Constance Miller, who is an expert madam.
Played by Helena Bonham Carter?
No. Might as well have been.
Yeah, right?
It's weird because Julie Christie was British, but man, is that accent she does terrible.
It is over the top.
You'd think a British person would be able to do a good British accent.
I thought Dick Van Dyke was on set. Hello, Governor!
Mary Poppins!
Hey, McCabe, we need to make a deal here. I'll take four eggs and a piece of toast.
That's a good impression, Dave. That's exactly what she sounds
yes!
like.
Oh, I have the Welsh rare bit. All right. So.
I'm going to smell opium.
So, yeah, Mrs. Miller convinces McCabe to partner with her because she knows that to run a successful brothel, you need attractive women with good hygiene, and she can handle all of that.
Man, is that a great... That was probably one of my favorite scenes in the movie. Where
it was
she,
excellent.
They go... Basically, she's like, I'm starving, and they go to the Sheehan Saloon,
yeah.
And she gets all this food, and she's eating it. And it's the first thing we realize that McCabe, because up until this point, McCabe,
yeah. McCabe is the man.
He's really competent, and you're like, oh, he's a fucking smooth operator. And this is the first thing we realize, oh, he's kind of a doofus.
Yeah.
Because she just like throws him under the bus, yeah. basically.
And she immediately criticizes the way he's dressed in a cheap suit. Or
no, no, it's a cologne.
Oh, okay. She, yeah.
And basically,
okay.
yeah, she points out that, like, you know, if you're going to manage women, which prostitutes are, you need to know things about women, like about menstruation and all that stuff,
and
which
pregnancy,
yeah, which McCabe has no idea yeah. about. And she's like, you know, if you don't listen to me, this town will be clapped up in no time, yeah. which is a great fucking line.
So they go into business together and they're very, very successful. But then these two corporate cronies come into town and they right. want to purchase all of McCabe's holdings in, I believe they're zinc mines.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, they want to purchase his zinc mines. And he tries to play hardball, but we find out that McCabe is the world's worst negotiator.
He's bad.
He's yeah. usually really drunk.
Yes, so he's drinking a lot at this point. And
well, he's got the hots for Mrs. Miller, basically.
He certainly does.
He's basically in love with her, and there's a scene where they go to bed together, but she makes him pay for it.
It's strange because without Mrs. Miller, McCabe isn't going to be as successful as he ends up being.
Right.
And that's what gets him in over his head is he's not used to that level of success.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she even tells him, you think small. You have to think
yeah.
big.
Yeah.
And so he thinks he's thinking big when he's negotiating with these two men. What are the names?
Sears and Hollander, but he calls them Sears and Roebuck.
Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah. And everywhere in print I was looking, I couldn't find that Roebuck mentioned anywhere.
Yeah.
But well, I know I heard it.
Well, it's because there was the store Sears mm-hmm. was originally called Sears and Roebuck way long time ago. Yeah. So he's basically making a joke
okay,
on that.
All right. I didn't realize that was humor. I thought that might have been a slip of the tongue.
I thought it was they were supposed to be the real Sears and Roebuck, but I have the thing. And Sears is played by Michael Murphy, who is a great character actor. He
yes.
pops up in pretty much everything. You know if you see him, basically.
So, yeah, they're sent to negotiate. Buying out McCabe, and they propose. What do they propose? $5,500 at first,
something yeah. like that. Yeah.
And he says, "No, you can $12,000 is my price, gentlemen." And then they come back later that night. He tries to butter them up with some free prostitution.
Who is?
Yeah.
And they come back to him with what was it, $6,250?
Yeah.
It's not much more, and he's like, "Let's have breakfast tomorrow." Also, it's worth pointing out that they work for a character named Shaughnessy, who we never see,
yeah.
which I like that touch too.
I do too.
Because this character basically just represents the machine, the industry
right.
that you just like
it's
the
faceless.
Faceless industry who's just buying out the little man. Basically.
And so the guy that William Plainview is. Daniel Plainview plays, his name's Donaghy, so it kind of,
yeah.
he might be like a character like that,
yeah,
who
yeah.
is like a huge baron
yeah,
that wants this land.
I mean, it's implied.
I took these guys
that.
As the Standard Oil
yes.
stand-ins,
yeah.
you know, for this film.
And I like this scene because it recalls those scenes in There Will Be Blood where Daniel won't make a deal
right.
with them over the pipeline.
Yeah, he's too stubborn, basically.
But in his case, he has the balls to back it up, whereas McCabe doesn't.
McCabe's yeah. just a fool.
Yeah, Daniel Plainview is much better at his job than McCabe.
So
this doesn't recall that. Those recall this. Sorry.
Well, yeah. Well, I know what
I
you're
don't
saying.
Want to sound like a complete idiot.
Yeah. This is such a ripoff of There Will Be Blood.
So he tries to get them to meet him over breakfast, and they hightail it out of town.
And Mrs. Miller is like, you're an idiot.
Yeah, they're going to – don't you know what they do? They kill people
right.
that don't make deals with them. And so
the movie shifts gears at this point.
Yeah, it becomes something else entirely.
It's interesting. I was reading The Dissolve did a big piece about McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
Oh.
And they were saying basically – it's interesting because like – for all of Altman's like resistance for being cinematic, this film inadvertently becomes cinematic. It
oh,
becomes
yeah.
like Altman hates plot and he hates character, but this film just it can't help but be turned into
this is
like,
heavily plot driven.
Right. Yeah.
Heavily. So these two men, they leave town, and in their stead comes this
butler.
Yeah, his name's Butler, and I want to call him a bounty hunter.
Yeah.
What he does is he closes deals that they can't make by, you know, murdering
I love this character. I love this performance. The actor's name is Hugh Milius, I guess you would pronounce it.
Milius, I thought it was.
Yeah, and he's really big. One character says, like, he's 7 feet tall, which he's not, but he's just hulking.
Yeah.
And he's got this, like, fur thing on. It's just, he's imposing the minute you see him.
And so McCabe goes to see this man. So he puts on his giant bear pelt jacket and trudges through the snow to meet this butler. And they have this fantastic interaction. The best scene in the film, I thought.
It's so good.
Where McCabe is trying desperately to make this deal. And Butler asked him, well, you know, how much did you ask him for? And he says, you know, $10,000. Yeah. And Butler says, well, how much did you really want? And he says, oh, about, you know, $7,000. $6,250.
Yeah,
yeah. Eventually, he gets him down to the exact price that they were offering him. And he said, well, all right, well, let's make a deal. And Butler tells him, I don't make deals.
Yeah,
I wasn't sent here to make deals.
It's so good because the way it's playing out until that point is Butler is like, he's like, that's reasonable. That's a really good idea.
Yeah.
And McCabe's like, all right, let's do it. And he's like, no.
And it's great because you've seen this scene before, but it's in stuff that was made after this, like in gangster movies.
Right from the start, it's great because McCabe walks in and he's like, oh, let's talk in private. And Butler's like, no, we'll talk here.
Here's fine.
And it's like, it brings McCabe down because everyone...
Or to the bottom. This is where you know McCabe's place.
Because it's in front of... And everyone looks up to McCabe because he's, you know, he owns the town.
Yeah.
And fucking Shaughnessy... Well, what's that character? Not Shaughnessy.
Sheehan.
He hates McCabe, basically.
Because McCabe would not partner with him in the beginning of the film. He instead partnered with Mrs. Miller.
Yeah, and so you see Sheehan, like, smirking. It's just like, McCabe.
So this butler tells him, I don't make deals. Yeah. I'm not here to make deals. And McCabe asks him, well, what are you here for? And my favorite line in the whole film is, I'm here to hunt bear.
Yeah.
And you just saw McCabe put on this giant bear pelt, and it's so... wonderful. I just love that dialogue. It does a lot for me.
It's great. Yeah.
And so McCabe leaves with his tail between his legs, and then the climax of the film comes.
Right, and it's this long, really well-filmed stalking sequence, basically.
Yeah. In the snow these three men hunting McCabe while the town sleeps.
I loved how, like, quiet it was, because, like, when I think of, like, snowy days, I think of that, like, you go outside and it's just, like, really quiet.
It's the tranquility.
Yeah, and it's like this film, this sequence captures that perfectly.
Yeah, it did a lot for me. There's these three men after McCabe, one of which is Butler, one of which is this maniac they just refer to as the Kid, who kills Keith Carradine's character. By tricking him.
There's this cute little setup where Shelley Duvall's character, she's, like, nervous about having sex, and it's implied that Keith Carradine's character has, like, a tiny penis.
Yeah.
And they sort of, like, they hit it off, because it's like, you can have sex with him because he's got a tiny dick, so you won't get hurt at all. And it's sort of like, oh, it's a funny thing. And immediately after that, he gets killed on a bridge. And this, I love this scene, too, because it's great. It's fucking dark and upsetting.
There's this standoff on the bridge where Keith Carradine doesn't even know it's a standoff.
Yeah.
This maniac killer, they call the Kid.
Yeah.
And he is a kid.
He's a kid, yeah. He looks like he's 16, 17 years old.
Yeah.
He tells Keith Carradine, they're on either ends of this wood bridge, and he tells him, let me see your gun.
Yeah, he's like, oh, because Keith Carradine's like, I'm not a good shot. And the kid says, what kind of gun do you have? And he says, I have a Colt. And he's like, those are good guns. Let me see it. Maybe something's wrong with it.
I can fix it. So Keith Carradine goes, okay. And he goes to pull his gun, and the kid draws his gun. Fires at Keith Carradine, shoots him dead off the bridge.
Yeah, he falls into, like, the ice, which I'm sure was a nightmare to fucking film. Just, like, imagining that. Just, like, lay on that ice.
And the other man, I'd never caught his name.
They call him Breed, basically, because he's sort of, like, part Indian.
Yeah, part Indian.
And he never talks, which is kind of cool, too.
So they're on the hunt for McCabe throughout this town, Presbyterian Church, and McCabe is hiding, and it's great because he's playing the coward. And you never see this in a Western where the hero is afraid of the people after him. The hero is always this, you know, stoic, strong type, but McCabe is visibly afraid for his life.
I liked that, and that's what really makes it an anti-Western to me, because you're in the Westerns, you get the showdown, and in this, you don't get that.
He's shooting people in their back. He's killing them from behind.
Even a film like Unforgiven, which I would also call an anti-Western, mm-hmm. that has a whole ending where Clint Eastwood's character, he visibly goes to confront everyone, and McCabe, he gets that he wins basically by hiding and shooting people in the back, basically.
He's doing the right thing because I think that he's trying to save the town from this machine moving in, but he's going about it in a way that is natural to him, which is the coward's way. Yeah.
Sneaky.
Yeah, he's being stealthy. He's hiding in between buildings. He's hiding in the snow. He tries to hide in a church, and he climbs up to the bell tower and looks out, and he sees these three men. He knows where they are. When he climbs back down, his gun is missing, and that is another poetic scene where this holy man, I guess he's the town priest, tells him he's got McCabe's own shotgun drawn at him, and he tells him, this is a house of God. Get out.
Yeah.
And that is definitely in response to McCabe's, you know,
bringing in the whores,
bringing in the gambling, bringing in the drinking, and ruining this town that was called Presbyterian Church, because that church at one point was the most important building in town, and now it's the brothel.
And I love that. Like, you don't see the priest the whole movie, but the second you see him with that gun, you feel that he hates this guy.
Yeah.
And has hated him the whole movie.
Yep. And then it backfires because Butler blows the priest's arm off.
Yeah, so McCabe leaves without his gun, hides in the snow, and Butler comes into the church and fires right at the priest, kills him, and knocks over a lamp, which starts a fire in the church.
And so everyone, there's a guy, I don't even know what the hell this character was, but he's just out. And he sees the fire, and he runs through the town screaming, "The church is on fire!"
And I love that.
Yeah, because
the whole town comes together.
Yeah, everyone gets brought together to put out the church.
And even the minorities who are second-hand citizens, second-class citizens, they're helping in, you know, bringing the water pail up to put this church fire out.
And it's an interesting contrast because the whole movie, these characters, you know.
You see them in the saloon gambling.
Yeah, they don't care about the church, but
the
church
is. They're whoring, they're gambling, they're drinking.
But now the church is on fire. They're all, like, committed. They're all joined together to put this church, you know.
And I don't really look at that as, you know, the film condemning McCabe.
No.
Because I think McCabe is kind of he's removed from any type of judgment that the film can make.
I would say it sort of represents, I don't know, it's just not condemning, it's just like the act of turning one's back on something. Sort of, because if you're going to bring in the whole Vietnam thing, it's just sort of that sort of concept where everyone loved McCabe.
Yeah.
And he basically just dies alone in the snow, and it's like no one fucking even
for the town. He dies to save the town,
and no one cares. Like, no one gives a shit
because McCabe does hunt these three men down, and there's the showdown, if you want to call it that, is Butler shoots McCabe in the back. McCabe collapses into the snow and falls on his back, and Butler comes closer to finish the job, and McCabe draws that Derringer from his sleeve and shoots Butler in the middle of the forehead.
I love that. It's
and
so
then
cool.
Dies in the snow a la Jack Torrance in Kubrick's
The Shining. That was just, like, that was fucking brutal.
It
like,
was.
It, like, I could just feel how, like, cold both physically and metaphorically it was, just because, like, you just see McCabe just slumped over from a distance. You never see like a close up, which I love that too. And it's just like, ugh. Poor McCabe, basically, is that ending.
I struggle with that, like if McCabe is redeemed, but I think even it goes back to him not taking the deal. And I think that was mostly motivated by the fact that he didn't want to sell his holdings. Like he isn't motivated by greed. He likes the power, and he wanted to be that guy that everyone thought he was.
Well, he's the small businessman. He's you and me. You know, he's a capitalist.
Yeah.
And this movie is about capitalism crushing guys like that because corporations have the real power. Yeah, he had the power in that town, but the corporation, it was coming in regardless of whether McCabe saves the town from these three bounty hunters. That corporation is coming in anyway.
Well, that's the problem at the end.
Yeah, he's dead. They're taking his zinc mines. They're taking everything.
Yeah, because there's nobody, like, and there's no next of kin or anything.
Yeah, because the final shot of the film reveals that Mrs. Miller is just...
She's an opium
She's addict. Zoinked out of her mind on opium, basically.
She's taking goofballs.
She's hopped up on goofballs.
But yeah, so this is a very cynical film in the end.
Yeah, it's basically, it's like you can't fight City Hall. That's the message of the cave and Mrs.
He fought
Miller.
The law and the law won.
It's a bleak fucking movie. It is.
And that's where I feel like There Will Be Blood is like a continuation almost of it. Because then it shows you, like, what's his name? Chauncey?
There Will Be Blood is almost like
the continuation of that. And it shows that even that guy gets left in the same situation, right? Because it's not...
The power and the greed are really what's running the show.
It's the capitalist...
They chew everything up.
Yeah. The ideology itself is the demon.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a neat movie, if I can use that sort of term.
This is a great movie, McCabe and Mrs. Miller.
I was impressed by it. I mean, there are things I don't like the overlapping dialogue gets to me.
It's distracting.
And I get, like, Altman's thing was he wanted a more natural, realistic thing. And from a personal standpoint, I don't go to the movies for realism. And I like escapism. And when I say that, I don't mean I need movies to be mindless blockbusters. I get enough of the real world in the real world. The reason I love movies so much is they let me experience things that I'm never really going to fucking experience.
Yeah.
And when a movie goes out of its way to be realistic, it just puts me off, you know?
See, I can go either way. With a film like this, the realism aspect of it didn't, you know, make it less enjoyable for me. But you can also take it to the other extreme where it's too fantastical.
Yeah.
With, you know, like Terrence Malick.
Right.
His films are like dreams.
Yeah.
And it's just the complete opposite of Altman's realism, where you're like, I don't like this at all.
I mean,
I feel like I've taken something very, very bad.
I mean, I like a middle ground. I don't mean like the details. Like, I love the realistic period details. I mean, from a filmmaking standpoint.
Right.
Like, I want my movies to be movies. I want them to be cinematic. I want them to show me things I can't see in real life.
This definitely toes the line. Definitely tiptoes across that line nicely.
It feels like he reluctantly was like, all right, I'll make it cinematic.
Yeah, it's got enough of a plot where it feels like a full movie.
Yeah.
And especially that where it turns into the showdown. It's definitely like a very climactic movie scene.
I mean, overall, I did really enjoy the movie more than I thought I was going
Same here.
Yeah.
It kind of, I don't know, this is an absurd analogy, but
I don't believe the
Back to the Future Wild West. Like, I see a lot of this in that.
I'm sure it was inspired.
Like the cowardly aspect of it, and even Biff in that reminds me of the guy.
I would say any Western that came out after this movie probably is borrowing from this movie.
Absolutely, because this really set the tone for post Vietnam films in general.
Yeah.
Really, it's got that biting. It's not satire, but it's cynical. It's got that biting cynicism. Yeah. And, you know, you see a lot of that in 70s cinema.
Would you say it's
Taxi
more
Driver
or less biting than Casualties of War?
Oh, boy. Well, Casualties of War is...
it's
a juggernaut of cynicism. Ugh.
So that, like, shows how De Palma dropped the ball there, because you can critique the Vietnam War in such subtle, beautiful ways.
Like an artist.
Film. Yeah.
You can do it as an artist.
Somehow this movie about fucking 1902 is a better Vietnam movie than Casualties of War,
which is
pretty telling for that movie.
But even a more literal film about the Vietnam War, like The Deer Hunter,
is
far better than a film like Casualties of War.
Right. You don't need to just, I don't know, that movie, let's not go back to that.
Hey, I like to mix the director series together.
It's a journey.
So what did you guys think of the two leads? We already talked about Julie Christie's boffo accent.
I thought she was really good in the role, aside from the accent.
Yeah,
that
too.
Was a little bit much, but I thought she was excellent. She was you know, she had some good, she got her digs in McCabe and I'm not a big Warren Beatty guy.
Right.
Yeah, me neither. So I wasn't too excited, but this kind of did the Ryan O'Neill thing where he grew on me.
He's the perfect.
Yeah. He was really good.
He's the perfect McCabe here. Have you ever heard interviews with Warren Beatty?
Not really.
He is the most boring person
probably
I've ever heard talk, and that comes through in a lot of his performances.
Yeah.
But in this film, he's just a lot of fun. He's so, like, he has these one-liners like, what do you got, a turd in your pocket?
Yeah.
What does that even mean?
And he keeps saying it. Like, the first time it's funny, but then the next time you're like, come on.
Well, yeah, there's a part where he calls a character a butternut muff diver, which is like my favorite fucking line.
That's the man he buys the prostitutes from.
Yeah,
right?
He's like, you butternut muff diver? I'm like, what a good line. So
I'm going to put that in all my reviews from now on.
So what did you guys think of the relationship between McCabe and Miss? Basically, my question is, it's clear that McCabe, I would say, I guess, is in love with Mrs. Miller. Yeah. How do you think she feels about him? Because she keeps trying to point out that it's like, I don't really like you. I just care about the business. But do you think that's like a facade?
By the end, I think she loves him.
Yeah.
And I think that's why she turns to the opium in such a dramatic way at the end. Because the last time you see Mrs. Miller is in an opium den.
Right.
You know, laying down, zoning out. And I think that she misses McCabe. He's dead and her life is, you know, the corporation's coming in and she's got nothing.
You don't see those. I saw the ending happening simultaneously.
Yeah, I thought that was all like as the town is celebrating and stuff myself. I mean, I could be.
I didn't see it's not happening.
That's awesome that can be taken in two ways.
It could be taken. It could be taken that it's like weeks later and she's upset.
That's how I took it.
Yeah. But it's hard to say. Like,
this is a good like Altman primer.
I agree.
You're
not diving. You're not going headfirst into the deep end. You're tiptoeing into the shallow end first.
Yeah. So I guess we'll see how Altman continues from this. This was the of the three movies. This is the earliest of the film.
Is The Long Goodbye next?
Yeah. The Long Goodbye is next, which has fairly good reviews, and I'm interested to watch that because everyone keeps comparing it to Inherent Vice. So I'm really interested to see how they play against each other.
I'm excited. Shall we recommend some movies?
Yeah, let's recommend away.
Goldfinger.
We certainly weren't expecting that. I don't know what I was expecting, but that wasn't it.
You had to record that in the basement?
I did. Usually if I have to record a recommendation song, I do it before my wife gets up, but she was up early today, so I had to hide in the basement to record this.
When are you moving out?
Go home and all my clothes will be on the lawn.
She heard you. You didn't know.
I'll go first.
All right, good.
This week, you know, the 46th episode of the Cuprin Film Podcast, I'm going to recommend a documentary that is up for the Best Documentary Award at the Academy Awards this year.
Cool.
Citizen 4. Citizen 4, all one word. I did this thing with my hand where I like slid it across like
for
Vanna
all
White.
For all those people at home who could see that.
It's about the Edward Snowden scandal that took place, what was that, 2012 when that happened?
Or somebody ought to take that man a shovel if he snowed in.
Like we will be tomorrow. all the Californians won't get that joke. Anyway, Edward Snowden, this movie directed by Laura Poitras, who is a documentary filmmaker. One of her other movies, My Country, My Country, was nominated in 2006. Mm. And because it's about the Iraq War, and because of that, she was selected, is what the NSA calls it, where they start monitoring your communications.
Good for her.
And Edward Snowden knew this because he could access that system. So he came across this information, saw that she was selected, and reached out to her to make this documentary before he leaked any of the information.
Oh, wow.
I believe he sent her a message and it said ASL.
So this movie actually records it. It takes place before the leaks happen and after,
it's like during the leaks.
Yeah. It gives you incredible like insight into how it was planned.
That's fascinating.
It's pretty incredible and it's very chilling. I'm a paranoid person on a normal day, but after watching this, I unplugged my Wi-Fi and everything else in my house.
Dave went off the grid.
Yeah, so but he hopped right back on the grid.
Yeah,
though.
For the podcast. Yeah.
Really strange because Snowden's kind of a weird guy, but he's also has that like likability factor because you can tell he's doing this purely on principle. He's not trying to be like a superstar. He repeatedly says like, I don't want my name out there until after the story breaks of the leaks, because he was afraid the media would turn the narrative of the story
about him,
which they did.
Yeah, of course.
Although I just watched it too, and there's a thing that bothered me where every time the reporters come to his room, he's like laying on the bed in like his t-shirt and he has no shoes on. And that just bugged me because it's like if reporters were coming over and I was about to spill NSA secrets, I'd be like, I'm going to put some shoes on.
I don't like that he was asking them if he made them Randy.
it's just weird because like he's spilling all these secrets and he's like laying on the bed. Fucking feet are in the camera. Like, put some shoes on.
I think that is a result of he's locked in. He can't leave this hotel room. He's called out sick from work.
Right.
Flown to Hong Kong and is now living in. He can't leave the hotel room. And I think these reporters are with him most of the day, every day. So
right.
You're seeing him throughout the day. He can't always be sitting in a chair, prim and proper. The weirdest part is how unprepared for like. His life being destroyed, he seemed, and like how unprepared to just disappear he was.
Right. He didn't seem like he had a plan. Basically, like he went to Hong Kong and he told his girlfriend, he was like, oh, I'm going away for work. And it's like, you probably should have had a better plan than that when you spill state secrets or whatever.
Luckily, Julian Assange's people stepped in and saved his ass. Mm. And now I guess he's in Russia, that's just living a normal life.
I heard.
So yeah, check that out. Citizen 4, do you think it's going to win?
I forget what else is nominated, but probably
Vivian Maier and the Vietnam documentary that Rory Kennedy did.
I mean, Citizen 4 is the most high profile, and that's what tends to win. So I would say that would win.
Okay.
Although I don't think it is the best of those documentaries,
but it's a good film.
Yeah,
very good.
All right.
Go, Mordecai.
What the hell was that? Oh, that's from Royal Tenenbaums. Yes. I was so confused.
Who wants to go?
I'll go.
All right.
My pick is a recent movie, and you can read my review for this on cutprintfilm.com, and It is The Duke of Burgundy.
Ooh.
So this is a...
Is this The Duke of Burgundy?
No, it's not. That's not anything. So The Duke of Burgundy, it's an IFC film. It's on demand. I don't know where it's on demand because I haven't seen it, but it is available on demand, and it's available in select theaters, and it'll get a wider release eventually.
I think it's on iTunes. IFC's movies usually go on iTunes, right. Yeah.
But this is one of the best films I've seen in years. Not just of this year, just in general. It's so well made. It's from Peter Strickland. He directed a film called Barbarian Sound Studio, which I didn't like that much, but this is so much better. And basically, it's about these two women. It's somewhere in Europe. We never learn where or what era it's set in. And they have this this S&M relationship with each other. And I know people hear that and they instantly think, oh, this is a dirty film. But it's not at all. This is like a classy
art. Or make my jeans tight?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, if you're like me, it will. But it's almost like if Wes Anderson made like a dirty movie, it would be this movie. Because it has that stylist sort of thing. And everything's sort of like fetishized where it's just like close-ups on like butterflies.
Nylon,
and so. Yeah. It's I don't want to like give it away because like I feel like this is a movie you need to see. The less you know, the better it is. But it's such a remarkable movie and it's gorgeous. And
yeah, I saw the trailer for it and I got to be honest, it did not do anything for me. I thought this is a movie I can just go without seeing at all. But I saw your review. You gave it a 9.5, yeah. Which I was like, well, I have to see it now.
I really hope both of you watch it because I do think both of you will like it, even if you don't like. The story, just from like a cinema standpoint, it's just such a gorgeous movie, and this will definitely be on my personal like top 10 at the end. I know it's the beginning of the year, but I know for a fact this is going to be on like my top 10 of the year.
Sometimes a film comes along and it makes itself perfectly clear. Hello, you'll be talking about me later this year.
Yeah, it's so good. So seek it out, The Duke of Burgundy.
Go, Mordecai.
All right, I will.
He's a part-time rogue, I hear.
Hey, speaking of Mordecai. I've done it, everybody. I've brought this entire podcast into a satisfying conclusion, almost like Robert Altman did with McCabe and Mrs. Miller. I've taken Johnny Depp and I've combined him with an anti-Western, and I'm recommending to you the 1995 film Dead Man.
Ah, I love this movie.
Starring Johnny Depp, directed by a director I'm not that thrilled about.
No, me either.
Jim Jarmusch, who did Only Lovers Left Alive earlier this year, which I did not really love.
I did.
Yes, Dave liked it, and Chris liked it.
I didn't like it as much as Dave, but I didn't dislike it as much as Jim. I'm in the middle.
So yeah, this is Dead Man. It came out in 95. You've probably seen this on Netflix every single time you fire it up and you think, well, this is something I'll never watch because it's Johnny Depp in a boat.
The second you said it, I was like, I know that. And I typed it in and that picture came up from Netflix.
And the font used in the poster is pre-installed with Windows 95. Yeah. It's Bones spelling out letters.
I believe it's Spooky Bone font. It's called
Stinks.
Is it the Dracula blood font?
No, that would be the next best thing.
But yeah, this is...
it's called Roll Dem Bones.
This is kind of a case of mistaken identity. Johnny Depp stars in it. Gary Farmer's in it. Billy Bob Thornton. Iggy Pop has a really fun role.
It's got great... Lance Henriksen is in it. It's got a great character.
The great Lance Henriksen. The not that great, usually, Crispin Glover.
Oh, I love Crispin Glover. Oh.
And Robert Mitchum, this is his final role. It's... kind of like it's called a psychedelic Western, referred to by Jim Jarmusch, and it includes twisted and surreal elements of the Western genre. And it's entirely in black and white. And Johnny Depp's character is basically mistaken for this killer.
Right.
And that's all I'm really going to say. It's kind of like a comedy.
Yeah. Also, his character name is William Blake.
Yeah.
So there's a Native American Indian character who keeps thinking he's the poet William Blake.
Yeah. It's really funny. Depp is great as this reserved character.
Yeah. He's a normal guy in this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. He's an everyman.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, kind of what I want to see here.
Yeah.
Like, we don't need goofballs every time.
No birds on your hat.
Oh, I just stole my joke.
Yeah. No. He is wearing a top hat similar to his Mad Hatter, except this is a good movie and not a terrible piece of garbage.
So Dead Man Down, that's what you're recommending?
No. This is called Dead Man. It's on Netflix. It might be on other streaming services because I'm sure this was purchased for free. I'm sure this didn't cost any money by any of these.
It's one of those
services.
Ones they like tack into the package.
Oh, yeah.
Like, we're giving you 40 movies.
Yeah.
Have to take Dead Man.
But it's really good. It's a fun movie. It's funny. And it looks great. It's crisp. It's got that black and white.
It's gorgeous.
Similar to Ida.
Oh,
it's black and white, but it's crisp and clear. And it's not, you know, it's not grainy or anything like that. So, yeah, Dead Man, 1995, starring Johnny Depp.
This podcast is over, man.
Yeah. Oh, it sure is.
Pack your things.
And then unpack them. There's no need to move out.
Yeah,
the podcast will return next week.
Plus, you're probably listening to us at home, so why are you packing, weirdo?
We didn't mean to fool anybody.
So what do we got coming up?
We have a lot of reviews because there are a lot of films coming out this week.
Right.
And none of them are any good.
Sorry. We also have a lot of editorials, too.
Yeah, we've kind of mastered the art of content, so we are a website like all the other movie websites. We have we're actually a lot better than all the other ones.
Yeah, you know what? We're better than 90% of other movie websites. Sorry, everyone, but it's true.
And we're also better than 90% of streaming pornography websites.
Yeah.
You don't even need to go there. Just come to our site and read. Do something for yourself. Pull your pants up. You don't need to do that. You're better than that. Read our content. It's fantastic.
And when you get done reading it, why not comment on it? There's a comment section. Why not go to Twitter and say, hey, @CutPrintFilm.
You saved me from jerking off.
Yeah.
That's right.
Thanks, guys.
And that's all I really care about. Save that.
And if you need to spend your time doing other things like listening to podcasts.
Or jerking off.
You can go to joystickjerks.com.
It's right in the title, jerk, right there.
And listen to their podcast. They talk about video games, and it's a very funny podcast. They're doing a lot of good things over there, those three scamps.
Yes, they're rapscallions.
Who else can you check out?
You should also check out another podcast that's comprised of three rapscallions. It's called Anti-Fanboy, and they're at antifanboy.com.
And they are a self-described pop culture podcast, and I think that's the best way to describe them.
They use the pop-o-matic bubble.
They do. You can't really hear them because they're constantly popping the trouble bubble.
Pop-o-matic trouble.
You can listen to them. They talk about video games, comics, comic book movies, all sorts of stuff.
Board games.
Yeah.
No, not so much board games.
Titty twisters, they talk about them.
Speaking of bored, if you want to be really bored, why not go to morelikeradio.com?
And look at the slider where they have 1,400 podcasts you can listen to, or you can choose not to listen to any of them.
And then when you get done looking at the slider, put a bullet in your gun and put the gun in your mouth.
And then eat it, because it's made of chocolate. This gun's delicious.
Okay, boys, we went 23 minutes over. Sorry about that.
Oh, wow. Just like Robert Altman, we don't know when to quit.
We're not good at self-editing.
I have a quick topic just to finish the podcast.
Okay, good. Perfect time.
What's What's your favorite movie?
Dave, I'm going to punch you in the nose. So yeah, check in with us next week. We'll be talking about Robert Altman's The Long Goodbye and other stuff, probably.
Speaking of long goodbyes.
Well, this has gone on far too long.
It's a 3-minute outro. Unnecessary.